going to be doing now for the next almost an hour or so, if it takes that long, is to talk together about some of the good signs of the Spirit's work in the church. And there are a lot of them around. I think it's easy to focus on the things that are not working right in an organization. It's kind of like going down a road, and if you hit one pothole on a mile stretch of road, you say, that really is a rotten stretch of road, because I hit that pothole. And that's what you remember. You don't remember all of the vast majority of fine pavement that was there. And I think that's kind of the way it is in the church. It's easy to focus on the things that are not working, because they are so apparent. Whereas the matrix that's holding everything together, which is actually a much more solid kind of part, is not so apparent. So, I would like for you to think a little bit first, kind of sit back and quietly think. So I've noticed some of you are already doing that during my So this will give you permission to do that. To sit back, actually close your eyes for a short period of time. Some people have been known to fall out of their chair. For a short period of time, and think back into situations in which you have felt there were really nourishing going operations in the church, any aspect of the church. Either individuals who you hearken back to and say, you know, that's a person who I can remember who was an inspiration to me. We'll give you a chance to talk about those kinds of people who you would say are some kinds of mentors, spiritual models to you. Or situations, congregational life, places where you've been welcomed, where you felt that that was a welcoming community and it was a nourishing community. Relationships and congregations that have nourished you over the years. We want you to share this. And we're involving here not just the people in the conference, but also spouses, others, heavenly hosts who are around from the community here. So let's take a couple minutes right now and just quick sit quietly and imagine yourselves back into situations in which there was health and nourishment, and think about the marks of those to share. Let's think first of all and share some examples of individuals you might be able to recall for the group that have been for you mentors or examples of spiritual maturity or spiritual leadership or kind of models of the faith. Who are those people? Call them up for us. Tell us some stories.
My teacher, Margaret Farley, Roman Catholic, Sister of Mercy, ethicist, my teacher at Yale Divinity School, who say words about them, Joe. Mm-hmm.
What was she like? What did she do?
What was she like? She was a brilliant scholar, equally at home with Aquinas and Martin Luther and all of the sainted teachers, but very, very open to new voices, particularly voices at the edge of society. But she had a way of speaking of her own faith in a way which was both very personal and profound. She would put a little card on her door at the beginning of the week with lines for appointments, and it was filled by that afternoon. So many people went to see her. When I was on my internship here, I called her in a panic because I was to preach on Easter Sunday. And I didn't know what to do about that, and so I called up Margaret in New Haven, and I said, what should I do? I just don't know what to say. And she said to me, Barbara, she said, you just need to tell people that you believe it. And it seemed like very almost too simple kind of thing to say, but I remember it every Easter at least, and Many days in between. She had a way of speaking from her heart about her own faith that was very, very moving.
You found yourself trying to do that also?
In a very different way, but she is the one who helped me see how very important that was to me, and then I could only imagine that it might be important to other people too. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you. Yeah, Chris?
Well, I share one who's in this room, Lowell Erdahl. He, I've known as a pastor. He was the pastor who was the preacher when I had occasion to live in St. Paul and attended there. I also knew him as a homiletics professor, and now I've come to watch him work as a bishop. But I think what has been, so I like to think of him as a mentor and model for me, and what I've always appreciated about Lowell is that his deeds match his words, and that has meant a lot.
Great. Yes.
No? I would mention Joe Sidler, about whom many people in this room know stories, but Barbara's comment about Margaret's faith being so real, that's what I think of when I think of Joe. His faith and his life were so completely integrated. There was such a joy and a naturalness about his faith, whether he was preaching from a pulpit or sitting at Jimmy's drinking beer and eating Polish sausage. There was an ordinariness about his faith, which I mean as a sacramental term. For him, God was present in the neighbor on the street corner as much as in the sacrament. There was a natural reality about his faith and life that is something I think about every time.
James.
I'm specifically remembering Dr. Wyatt T. Walker, who's the pastor of Canaan Baptist Church of Christ in Harlem, on 116th between Lenox Avenue and 7th. And this, I remember him particularly because he came at a time to our congregation when we were grieving over the death of the founding pastor of Canaan, and back in 1966, and brought this church to a point where it's around 3,000 members and 85% of them tithe. And the congregation and the congregation has been able to do so much in that Harlem community in terms of drug rehabilitation, in terms of senior citizen housing and so forth. And he really has been a model for me. And I'm particularly excited because I'm going to be preaching at that congregation this coming Sunday. And so it's like kind of going back home from the roots and getting in touch with those beginnings.
What would you say were some of the marks, or are some of the marks of that man that have helped him to be able to do the things you've described?
Dr. Walker, first of all, you know, he was first of all one of those. He was a right-hand man to Dr. King, you know, during the civil rights struggle. But he was a man who walked with somebody who had a vision. And he was a pastor who very carefully articulated that vision, first of all, to the official board. And the official board, the deacons and the trustees in that congregation believed it. And as a result of that, the congregation began to go forward. I mean, Canaan has never been the same ever since, you know, sometime in 1969. He began to really articulate, you know, what it is that Canaan was going to be in the Harlem community.
Great. Anybody else? Yes, one more. Two more.
I want to add another man, but here we go. I try to eat, have breakfast with Herman Deers every other Tuesday. We moved recently from Waterloo to Waterloo to Tacoma. Our city is the most violent city in the state of Washington. He moved into the midst of it, close by, and is associated with the parish downtown, but not the parish in the hilltop area, which is the toughest area. But that's where he works, organizing blocks of people in the name of Christ, but not organizing worship communities, but block by block to meet the drugs and all the other stuff there, bringing drug leaders and the rest of them in the community with his life in danger, without question, and doing that with a matter of about 6 or 8 months that he's been there. A man of guts, a man who has learned because he has done stuff overseas and learned from that, and a man who listens to his daughter as she teaches him. And I'm learning from him, but I ain't got the guts yet.
Thanks. Yes.
More Sitlariana. I remember him most vividly as a graduate student at the University of Chicago. And although I never took a course from him formally, I learned as much from him as any. And the thing that was always impressive to me was that he could see through my cloud of bravado and understand there was a rather delicate and frightened person out there, because, you know, coming in from the prairies to the University of Chicago can be a fairly intimidating thing, which it was for me. But he saw the good in me, and after he would encounter me, like, for example, I preached a sermon at Augustana where we both went. And he joked about it. He says, you know, most carpenters take down the scaffolding after they finish the house. I can see tool marks all over the place. But he said, you know, I sure know how you got there. And he says, it's a sound, wonderful house you built. I can't tell you what I felt like inside after he got done with me. I mean, in the one hand, he didn't overlook anything. See, it wasn't cheap grace. It wasn't anything fraudulent about overlooking my foibles. But he was still able to see beyond that and find the good in it. And I owe him a lot. I really do.
Great story.
I could do more Sitlariana too. He always told us how when he was a pastor in Ohio with one woman who was his best friend, an old woman who came by one week after one of his less good sermons, said, "Pastor, you've been very busy this weekend." I'm practical minded. I want to keep asking what this does for renewal of the church. But in order to get my ticket, I have to nominate somebody, my own pastor for 20 years. I will not tell you his name because there are bishops in this room and we don't want to lose him. But what he is, we wouldn't trade him for any other pastor I know. And I know a lot of good ones that I could also be served by. What I want to do quickly is a little mnemonic device on where I think what we're doing is useful. I read a book last year, and I Bible about it a lot, called Exemplum. That's the title. In the medieval dictionaries, exemplum, cutting out, was the word for a clearing in the woods. And an exemplar, we're describing human exemplars, Margaret Farley, they're exemplars. What the medieval dictionary asked, does the clearing in the woods do? Three things. One, it defines the woods. The woods is a thicket, and when you have the clearing, you know where it starts and stops, and you get a sense of it. And these human beings you're describing define the thicket for us. The second thing the exemplum did, what is a clearing for, is where the light gets to fall in. If you're lost in the woods, all of a sudden there's a light spot. And the third thing it does is you carve out the place where you can have cultivation. It's where the cottage is, it's where the fields grow, etc. It doesn't take away from the woods, it contributes to the woods. And I think one of the things we can do carrying home from here in the Lutheran Church is keep before people these exemplars, most of whom you'll never know the name of or care the name of. And I'd like to observe, I was at a conference last Saturday on religion and the media, at a new center that's being formed in Northwestern. And one of the things we more or less came away from, there were all the Peter Steinfeld, Dick Ostling, New York Times, and what most of the religious people in the room said is there's a big distinction between feature and news. Religious news is always bad news, because news is only news when there's conflict and so on. Ms. Weiss, who runs NPR, All Things Considered, called me and said, I've had a baby during the time the Pope was in Denver, and I listened to our station, and we do a horrible job. Because here's the Pope with 400,000 kids following him, and the only time we covered him is if he used the word abortion. The Pope and the kids is a feature. The Pope making bad news about women's ordination, which is about the worst news you could think of late in the 20th century, is bad stuff. As I read the Lutheran, every issue there are wonderful features about exemplars, little tiny churches that are clearings in the woods. The news part has to be bad, because that's where the conflict is. You have to report it. But I do believe that the hearts of the faithful are cheered by the kind of human beings. We didn't have to know any of the people we're talking about tonight, and we're better off, I think, for having heard that they exist. That's just my little pitch for remember the word exemplar.
Thanks very much for that. I was just jotting down kind of some traits, and let me list those, and then let's move on to thinking about situations and congregations or groups. I heard talking about the accessibility and the directness of these people. The fact that their faith was very real, and it was transparent in their lives. It was not something that was added on. It was mixed in. They were people, at least some of them were, they're not all the same people, obviously. The element of vision and bravery and being coherent, internally consistent, having a sensitivity to the place of other people, particularly people who feel very, very much less than those people are, an openness to smaller persons. And I would say this to you and this group. There are exemplars in this group. I could have named some people other than Lowell Erdahl. I'm not saying I wouldn't have named her. I would bet there are two or three people in this group that each of us could identify and point out in the same kind of way. And that's a tremendous gift.
Yeah, let me just say about the way Sittler treated me, I've tried to remember that every time I deal with a student. So in a sense, Sittler is passed along to North Dakota State.
Wonderful. Exactly. I've had conversations with people who say, where are the giants? And I say, maybe they are us. I mean, who perceives who is a giant or who isn't? The giant doesn't know, I think. We had pointed out in our group that people who are spiritual giants, who are classical mystics, are always talking about the things they are not, not the things that they are. And that they tend to return, people who are in the Christian tradition, return always to two things, that is to the Eucharist and to service. And that's one of the marks of a spiritual giant. It's not a disembodied person walking around through the world, but it's someone connected to the history, the tradition, to the gospel, to the Lord. Okay, now let's think about groups. Congregations, communities, both in the past and in the present. What are marks of communities of power, congregations of nourishment? Places where, when you go there, you don't want whatever is happening to stop. You want it to continue on. And you lose track of how long you've been there because of the power of what's going on and the energy that's flowing to you in that situation. Places like that.
Yeah. Wherever I've been as a parish pastor, I've found that in the group of clergy that has gathered for text study on a weekly basis. And that kind of nurture and just the deepening of the friendships, you know, have become the kind of things where it's very hard for us to stop after our hour, and it's very hard for us to stay away when we're even away from the city. I mean, our hearts are at that place, and that's the way I find it where I am now. I've had that experience in every place I've had the privilege of serving as a pastor.
I think of the community of Thésée in France, which is a monastic community composed of 80 or 90 persons, which has opened its doors to the youth of the world, has invited them to come and share in conversation, in prayer, and in food. And they've come literally by the thousands. When I was there, there were a little over 2,000 people in this village of 80, plus the community of 80 brothers. And they fed them all, housed them all in tents or wherever. And I was utterly amazed to see the vitality with which those young persons gathered three times a day for prayer. To gather three times a day for prayer, and then in between to share with one another in conversation about justice, about fairness, about faith, language being no barrier, because a group would gather and someone would be there who could speak French and Spanish and therefore translate. Just a very exciting vitality that the brothers were able to offer because of their sense of hospitality, their sense of the presence of Jesus Christ in their midst, and their desire to share that with those who came.
Thanks. Laura? If I admire 2 minutes of quiet time, thought of a congregation in our synod for which I probably have never expressed enough public gratitude. Our Savior's in Circle Pines, I'll tell you where it is, and the pastor, senior pastor, was George Johnson, former director of World Hunger for the ALC. But that congregation comes to mind as one for gratitude, because I think of a tremendous amount of time that I spend dealing with congregations in conflict. And here we have a congregation where they've had a very strong evangelical emphasis combined with tremendous commitment to social action, dealing with all of the issues, even the most controversial ones, including homosexuality. They have contemporary worship, they have traditional worship. In the 7 years that George was there, the congregation grew from about 1,400 to 2,700 members. And I've been involved a bit in the life of that parish, and never once have I heard a complaint from anybody. They've dealt with a doctor who had AIDS who died. And I think one of the keys of that, one of the lessons I've learned out of that, is what happens when a pastor is really bonded with the people. Mm. And the associate pastors, Phil Johnson and Dale Peterson, I should give their credit too, that I think is a tremendous thing when people are united. They're, this is my pastor. And then they're able to deal with this in a Christ-centered way that brings these differences together and holds them together. And to me, that's a tremendous model that we can keep in mind.
Could you spin out a little bit more? Why do you think that happened in that congregation?
I think one of the key things to me, what happened, is the pastor becomes bonded with the people. And there are all kinds of things that go into that. And I think a lot of the situations where we have conflict is because the pastor is not bonded. There's not that kind of a personal relationship. And I'll tell a little story I heard years ago from Reinhold Niebuhr, who told about a pastor in the South who got involved very deeply in the civil rights crisis and so on, and members of the congregation got mad, got up a petition to get rid of him. And they took it to one of the old-timers in the congregation, and he said he refused to sign the petition. And they said, "Why won't you sign it?" And he said, "You've forgotten something. What did we forget? You forget that my wife died 6 months ago and he was my pastor." Now, it isn't everybody's wife dies 6 months, but I think that key thing, he's my pastor, she's my pastor, there's a relationship there. And able to have respectful difference across the board on these issues and diversity of worship. Maybe they didn't win them all. Maybe there's some faded away without calling the bishop, but I never heard a word of complaint from anybody.
Thanks. Mark.
This was a moment that I wanted to stretch in time. About a month or so ago at the Lutheran Center, we still had the taste in our mouth of reductions that meant the loss of people and programs. But it was Rogade, and we gathered for worship, not in the building, but out in the courtyard, and surrounded tulips and flowering crab trees, and sang and prayed, and had to sing loudly as 747s zoomed over every 60 seconds. But there was a moment when I watched they brought out the preschool kids, and they were pouring water onto the flowers as a part of it. And we joined in prayer, and I thought of the people in the other buildings who would look down and of the planes going over and cars going by as we prayed for seed and soil in the midst of concrete and steel, and thought of the kind of hope that we placed in that moment, and the innocence of the kids who really felt they were the ones who were carrying that hope in that water for that moment. My impulse was to get a camera and run to the garage roof and take a picture and to remember it. But for me, that was a sign in the midst of everything else we've been through of the gathered community at that special time that connected with folks that weren't normally a part of that community.
Yeah. Thanks.
Bob. It just rushed through my mind all kinds of things. You know, I could talk about congregations, and I could talk about schools or campus ministries or any number of things. I'm going to talk about one thing, and this is for Mel and for Mark. It was the same old Christmas concert 2 or 3 years ago. These incredibly rich festivals have drawn these thousands upon thousands of people. And they have a new director, had a new director then. Happened to be an African-American person. And when they came in that year, marched in with the banners and the music, he had put together for that opening procession Gregorian chant and spirituals. I mean, that's an amazing combination of rhythms and tones and music. And just the richness of that whole experience, the way in which the church has the ability to take the arts and to use that to sound forth the gospel in extraordinary. Oh man, that's a gift. That's a gift.
Brady.
I want to share a different one, and it's not a paid promotion. But about 3 years ago, I enrolled in an Alban Institute called Congregation as a Nurturing Community. And it was one of the richest experiences that I've had in a long time. Not only did we experience community as a part of the workshop within our own small group of very diverse people from all over the country and all denominational backgrounds, but we were given a vision that the congregation could be different from what we thought it might have been. And their key expression was that every time you have people coming together in a congregation, it is an opportunity to build community. And the illustration they used was your governing board. And I stupidly went back and sold our church council on the fact that we were going to become a nurturing community. And we were going to spend about 45 minutes at the beginning of each meeting nurturing our relationships with each other and transform the church council. And we had a man, an executive in textiles, who had been transferred down from Pearl River, New York to Greensboro, North Carolina, and was quickly elected to our council. And he had lost his job. And he sat there at church council and he said, if somebody had told me 2 years ago that I would be sitting in a council meeting sharing with you the pain of losing my job, I would have said you're crazy. But it was an experience that it was a people who could communicate a vision, and it's an Episcopal priest and an Episcopal laywoman who did it. but who had the ability to translate that vision into a working model that they could send home with you, and that you could then begin to unpack in a real situation. And it, I think it really does work.
Has that continued on in that parish? I know you're not the pastor there now.
Yes.
Yeah. Great.
Suspended.
Yes.
I'd tell you about what I consider to be the mother church in Tacoma, Washington. St. Leo's Roman Catholic Parish. Years ago, the main parish, the main nave, burned down. And so they now worship in the basement quite happily. And you'd never know it was a basement, but it clearly is. Two stories. Beside the fact that on any given Sunday you're likely to find as many as five or six Lutheran pastors there, any Lutheran pastor who's loose on a Sunday will be at St. Leo's at the Mother Church. The richness of the community. I remember my first time at St. Leo's, sitting there, being kind of swept up in a quite profound and yet easy liturgical movement that was very dramatic and quite lovely and flowing and free, but yet had a depth that was stunning. And all of a sudden, being swept away in a kind of a reverie of something, I smelled urine. And I thought, I've never smelled urine in church before. And I realized that two pews ahead was the 8 or 10 members from the large community, and somebody wet their pants. I mean, it's my favorite smell in church. There was something that grounded everything right there. You know? I tried to recreate that smell now.
There's a way to do it.
Drink a lot of beer, Dan.
Apart from that particular, what's going on besides that?
Well, I don't know. See, it's quite mysterious. I mean, there's something quite lovely about what happens there, but I don't know what the heart of it is. They have this enormous horse trough in which they baptize people. I mean, it really is literally a horse trough, and they get them all wet. And the other story I remember is that we were at the middle of the liturgy and the priest was doing something informal, and then all of a sudden there was this enormous pounding knock on the back doors of the church. Absolutely intrusive. I mean, everybody stops, you know, dramatic. And the priest says, "Who's there?" And in walked the catechumens for the next season's class, to be presented to the congregation, and then and welcomed very formally. They pray for one another with arms outstretched towards the one for whom they pray. Everybody in the room, like wheat waving in the wind toward in blessing. I don't know what's happening there. I mean, you could sit there and try and decipher the place, but if you cut it up into pieces, you'd just have pieces. But something very good is happening there. It's a rich, rich. There must be 20 races of people worship there on a Sunday. Deeply graceful place. But I can't tell you what it is.
But you're talking about symbols. You're talking about drama. You're talking
color
about,
and the liturgy that we know and love in a sublime and gentle way that's just so gracious you can't resist it. Easy music, choruses that don't Marty Haugen's music, lots of contemporary Roman Catholic, St. Louis Jesuit stuff. But good preaching,
people come.
And trained readers who you hardly need a sermon when the readers are done with their reading, because they have proclaimed in the reading of the text. I mean, if anything I can think in our parishes that goes by the side, that's it. We put people to sleep when we start the lessons. That's when they pull out the paper for the kids, you know.
Read the book. Great. Thanks for that. Yes.
I like to claim that, at least for me, and I think for many others, that an exemplum literally of
clearing in the woods is the place you're all sitting right now. And I think I can identify why. Like any other clearing in the woods, there are times when it's stormy and it's times when it isn't that much of an example. But when it's working best, I think it is a place of renewal and excitement, and it's because it's open to the marginalized, it experiments in liturgy, it pushes the boundaries of the church. You have a feeling here of being on something that's new when it's working best. It's a place where everyone works. At one point, even the guests work. It's a place that worships every time and is particularly strong in music and trying new things in the liturgy. And it's a part in some way. And so although there are many things that are wrong with Holden Village, I think that it is one of those exempla, that makes a difference for the larger church. I mean, you can go anywhere in this country and you got a bunch of Lutherans together and mention Holden, there'll be a few there who have been strongly moved by the place.
There'll be a few more after this meeting.
Well, I hope that those of you who are here get a chance to actually get your hands wet in the dish team or talk to the staff or wander around and hike and then just enjoy the Vespers.
At least wear our pants.
Go to regular.
Great. Okay, what I'd like to do now is to move in a little different direction. I want to think about a concrete example of a congregation that we have. You all know about this congregation. And I'm talking about Community Church of Joy in Phoenix, which is one of the more avant-garde, experimental, kind of explosive places in our church. And I asked Walt Kallstedt if he would just talk a little bit about Community of Joy, not as an example necessarily, but just kind of as an instance of some of the new things that are happening in the church. What we're looking for here are for new handles for engaging the culture with the church. We know that many of the things that we do in kind of standard congregations on Sundays don't draw in the people who are walking past the church. Now, something that's going on at Community of Joy does draw those people in. And so I asked Walt, and I hope he's not too embarrassed, to just talk a little bit about it, to start us thinking in some of those directions for a few minutes. Walt?
Well, we have attempted to design a church for disconnected, unchurched people.
Could you move it to the middle so we have it?
Can you stay up there?
As we've attempted to design a church for people who don't go to church, we've had to listen to why people don't go to church. We've tried to carefully do our homework and getting into the community in areas where the least churched and Lutheran in Phoenix, Arizona is not a well-known term. They don't know what a Lutheran. I was asked many times when I arrived in 1978 what a Lutheran is. And I knew that we were called to reach people who had not been touched in any way by any Christian church. And in an attempt to do that, we have shaped our Sunday mornings as an outreach time. The number one station in Arizona is KNIX, it's country. So we have taken a country flavor at one of our worship experiences. We know that there are those who have a connection with a heritage, a Lutheran heritage. And so we have a spirited traditional opportunity, and that targets that particular group. It's oriented to that group. It is sensitive, certainly, to other less informed Lutheran Christians. But then 9:30, we start blending a lot of the new and start orienting ourselves to the totally unchurched. And by 11, then we have then 10:30, it's even more of a boomer buster. The music is probably more of your mix of rock and soft listening music. It's
more contemporary, and then at 11:30 we do a lot of alternative music, jazz, cutting edge, and finding that the heart music is a it really is an attraction. It's an opportunity to open people up and connect long enough to communicate the truth, to communicate the gospel. But we believe that that's a start. We as we connect, we have a commitment to help people grow and get involved in mission. Our ultimate dream is that the people who come would catch a vision for really dynamic, exciting mission, and we offer an intentional opportunity to go around a circle. We call it a circle of fulfillment, where growth opportunities, many growth opportunities, 7 days a week. We understood, at least in our community, that people are not free just on Sunday. If that's all we offer, a course or a Bible study or what, the work schedules are so varied, it's so diverse, that we had to do something 7 days a week to connect with many different entities. So we have attempted to carry out a 7 day a week church, trying to identify needs. And this is a twist. Many Lutheran congregations, at least that I've been a part of, orient themselves, and the people who decide what they're going to do in mission are already there. We have a commitment to offer and orient ourselves to people who aren't there yet. And that's a whole different orientation. And they are our first priority. So that's a challenge. That continually pushes us, and our imagination, our creativity. How do you interpret the gospel into that kind of an orientation, that kind of a context? And we believe failure is okay. We've probably had more failure than success. But to push the envelope, to experiment, to try new and different creative, innovative styles and methods, we don't believe that we're selling out, because we haven't compromised the truth. We don't compromise the gospel. But the methods and styles are quite unique, and they're contextualized. We don't at all claim that what we do in Phoenix, Arizona is the way to do it in New York City or in Seattle, Washington or whatever, but certain principles, I believe, are, and that is, you get in touch with the people who aren't going to church. If you really care about that, which we feel called to, they are our first priority. They're number one. And then we orient, then we work in mission and design our mission and strategy around that. I think that as we continue to sharpen our focus, we're discovering that there are changes. What worked 10 years ago doesn't work today, so you can't be afraid of change. Yeah, we love the church more than we fear change. So that's kind of a sense that drives us.
Great. Thanks very much, Walter. That gets some thinking going in the group. Let me just jot down or share with you some of the things I jotted as the group was talking about, those congregations or places that are the ones that stick in our minds as places of power and strength in the church. We talked about hospitality. We talked about vitality of the communities that are there. We talked about the presence of Jesus Christ and the unabashed proclamation of the gospel. You talked about an evangelical emphasis, social services, outreach into the community. You talked about pastor bonding with people so that there was a shared kind of ministry there. You talked about the congregation as a nurturing community. You talked about the congregation as a place where there were signs of hope, not of fear, but of hope. you talked about music and the arts being blended together in worship, and the powerful transportation that happens to a person caught up in that kind of a moment. You talked about St. Leo's in Tacoma and the drama and the kind of visceral, strong symbols, human of human engagement at basic levels. That's very Lutheran stuff. You know that. You know that's Lutheran stuff, as well as Catholic stuff, obviously. Being open to marginalized people, being open to experiments, and the things that Walt has just raised, of being open to the people who are outside. It rang a bell with something Marianne had said earlier in our group, and I think reported here too, about the fact that that the Lutheran Church really is not oriented to people who are outside the church. We're oriented to people who are looking looking for what we have to offer. And we're not out seeking those people, or many of our congregations are. The congregation that I go to on a Sunday morning is something I hate to miss. I don't want to miss church because it is so good. And the preaching is good. The worship is good. The sacrament is done every service 3 times a Sunday morning. There is a palpable vitality in the congregation, which is infectious, and it is growing. It's growing like mad. And it has a lot of these same kinds of marks. I know that this is happening in a lot of places around our country. And it is not at all disconnected from the ideas that we're talking about here of spirituality, of a Lutheran identity, of traditional Christian values, but somehow unhitched just enough to make it interesting, unhitched from tradition, and engaging people where they are. Another story or two. Yeah.
One thing that I haven't heard here, and I just got to say this, is that the importance of and the vitality of lay leadership in this church.
Yeah.
We've been very clergy-oriented here tonight, I don't think intentionally, but one example of that in our synod is a lay school of theology for lay people. There are lay people hungering and wanting significant learning in order that they may give of themselves and service back in their congregation. Most, none for pay, but this sort of non-stipendiary opportunity of the ministry of the laity. And I think that that needs to be held up as a blessing, a resource. And many, it's very interesting, the stories, some of these people go back and try to talk to their pastors. Their pastors either don't know how to talk to them, or are afraid to talk to them, or are not sure what to do with trained lay people. It's a threat to them. And I think we've got to find a way to help this partnership of lay leadership, which and pastoral leadership, to work together in a more profound and way of commitment to the mission of this church and this gospel. And I see it happening in some places, but I wish it was happening more places.
Great. One last comment, Bob.
This is precisely the kind of thing that happens in the church that I belong to. It's a church that is much maligned by jealous pastors. It's Mount Olivet in Minneapolis. 15,000 members, 8 full-time pastors, 2 of them are women, 5 of them are my former students. You can see how prejudiced I am. We have 6 services every Sunday from 8:30 to 12:30. 2 of them are Holy Communion. We lose about 400 members through deaths and transfer every year, but we take in about 800 new members every year. This is a congregation that is so big and so powerful because of its size and wealth that it can do powerful and wonderful things. They have a Rolling Acres, an institution for retarded children, retreat center, two nursing homes for elderly people, summer camp up near Lake Superior, and the senior pastor spends 2.5 months every year ministering to the youth at that summer camp. The only, you might ask, what is the success? Why is this congregation doing so well? Well, there's no jumping up and down and rolling in the aisles. Everything is done in a traditional Lutheran fashion. G.K. Chesterton said the only true democracy is tradition because it gives the dead a chance to vote. Well, this congregation is 75 years old, and it's going strong. It's growing faster than any congregation in the country. It's just amazing. The spirit there is just fantastic. Sermons are wonderful. Music is good. No rock and roll. No guitars. Organ music. Six choirs.
Terrific.
I can't. I'm not happy when I don't go to church too. Same as you.
Does somebody have a story about a small congregation that is a good congregation? Yeah, let's finish with that one, Jim.
Well, I don't have one. I have 230.
Yeah. 2 years ago, when we were having one of our many racial wars in New York City, they did a series on what works around the country to fight racism. I remember reading that one of the most effective things in the country is in public schools when they bring kids together of various races in small groups. And when I read that, I said, that's the Lutheran Church in New York City. There is scarcely, even in our white suburban areas, there is scarcely a congregation that you don't go into that is multiracial, multi-generational, multi-orientational, multi-everything. And I say to myself, where else voluntarily, I know in business and stuff, where else in the city of New York do people seek out and consciously choose to be in that kind of setting? The only place I can think of is that local, little, maligned parish church down the block, which I think is an image of heaven, and where indeed the dead are listened to. You know, there are sometimes a little too much.